On this episode of Warbird Radio Presents, we explore the archives of the EAA. Here now is the coordinator of the Timeless Voices Oral History Program, Zach Boffman.
My name is Zach Boffman, and I am the coordinator of EAA's Timeless Voices of Aviation Oral History Program. Since 2002, Timeless Voices has been recording videotaped interviews with people who have been involved in aviation during their lifetimes. Military and civilian pilots, mechanics, designers, and builders, from ultralights to astronauts, Timeless Voices has covered the entire spectrum of the aviation experience. This story comes from Charlie Plum, a U.S. Navy veteran of the Vietnam War who flew 75 combat missions in the F-4 Phantom. Charlie was shot down on May 19, 1967 and was captured, tortured, and held as a prisoner of war for 2,103 days. This is his story in his own words.
I grew up in Kansas, and my first recollection is to seeing Piper Cubs, or actually it's one Piper Cub owned by a farmer who I'm sure never had a license or a registration on his cub, and I saw that flying over the farm, and I well recall thinking it would be wonderful, but there's probably no way that a hayseed farm kid like me would ever be able to fly an airplane like that. Built models and flew model airplanes, you know, the U-control kind, just really, really simple, with an 049 engine on them, and just basic, again, dreaming about it. I was a part of the aviation club, and my high school principal, I'm sorry, he wasn't principal yet, at the time I went through high school, this guy was a math teacher, and he had been a Navy pilot in World War II. And he talked about flying off the aircraft carriers and flying the F-4U Corsairs and telling us all kinds of great stories in the high school classroom. Again, I thought that's a real pipe dream. I'll never be able to do that. I went right to the Naval Academy at age 17, and I'd never seen the ocean. At that time, I had never ridden in an airplane. I was basically a hayseed from Kansas, and I felt it was a brighter world. My parents couldn't afford to send me to college, and so I started looking for scholarships. My father had been 4F, not physically qualified, in World War II, and so the closest relative I had in the military was a cousin in the Coast Guard. But I saw this as an opportunity to get a good education and see the world and get out of Kansas. So I, at age 17, went to the Naval Academy and spent the next 4 years there. When I was at the Naval Academy, they would not let us take private lessons, even on our own expense, because they felt like that civilian flying was so much different from Navy flying that we'd learn to flare an airplane. And of course, in the Navy, you don't flare. When you're trying to get that three wire on an aircraft carrier, you slam that thing down. And so the philosophy at the time was, nobody can get private airplane flying lessons. There was none of that at all. Now, the second class summer at the Naval Academy, you get a sampling of the various opportunities you have after graduation. And so we went down and played Marines at Little Creek, Virginia for a while, and we did submarines in Florida, and part of it was Pensacola. And so I got to go down to Pensacola and see if those instructors down there could make me sick, and which is basically what they did. It didn't make me sick. They tried awfully hard. But I just fell in love with aviation at that moment and knew that that's what I had to do. And so my senior year at the Naval Academy, I applied for Naval Aviation and was accepted. I graduated in 1964. I married my high school sweetheart the next day, and we packed our bags and immediately went to Pensacola, Florida. Started pre-flight in Naval Aviation, flew the T-34, then went up to Meridian, Mississippi, flew the T-2J Buckeye, the jet. And in fact, John McCain was one of my flight instructors there. I'd gone to school with his brother Joe, so Joe McCain it was in the same company, and so I knew Joe well, and I'd met John, but finally had him as a flight instructor. Tough, really tough, and somewhat erratic, as a matter of fact. You did not want to get a check ride with John McCain. So, but, you know, he was also a real hellraiser at the bar, and I've seen him drink until 2 in the morning and get up at 6 for a 6:30 brief, and he did it. You know, he's just a really, really, he's a tough guy and very energetic and very focused. So, but he played a lot and he flew a lot and everything he did hard. He is a real maverick. Went on to Beeville, Texas from there. Flew the F-9 in training and the F-11. One of the few guys that ever fly the Tiger in training. Just a beautiful airplane. It's the one the Blue Angels had for a long time, and just an incredible, incredible airplane. So I felt really, and of course it's the first time, they only made them in single seaters. And so the first time you had an afterburner and a supersonic airplane with a three-dimensional gyro that was, you were taken off just by reading the book. We didn't even have good simulators for the F-11. And so you were on your own, rolling down that runway. And I'll never forget that trip. I got my wings and took my bride out to San Diego, where I flew some of the first adversarial flights for the Top Gun School at Miramar. Pretty exciting times. It all started when a buddy of mine, Paul Kruke, went through flight training with Paul, and I showed up at Miramar, assigned the F-4 Phantom, which at the time was the hottest airplane in the world. It was time to climb, all the records, really neat. But there was a six-month wait to fly that airplane. Paul and I were not too happy with waiting around to pilot an airplane, so we wandered down the flight line and found an F-9 squadron that was training instrument pilots. This was kind of an instrument refresher course for guys to keep their instrument ticket. And they put them in the back seat of an F-9 and drone around the sky boring holes, you know, while the guy under the bag in the back seat was shooting approaches and that kind of thing. So we thought, well, it's an airplane, and we're qualified to fly. We had flown it in the training command. So let's hop in here. So we started flying these students around in the back seat, you know, and, of course, never more than a 30-degree angle of bank, and it was really boring. And so Paul and I would save a little bit of fuel at the end of each flight, and we would go out over the water, and we would lurk out over the water and wait for the Phantoms come off the runway at Miramar and out to sea. And we'd get them just about the time they get gear up, we'd pounce on these guys. And we'd get into a real luffberry with these characters. And, of course, the Phantom, you know, from the ground up was built as a high-altitude supersonic interceptor. I was issued a full-pressure flight suit, an astronaut's bubble canopy, and, you know, the doughboy thing. I carried around an air conditioner and a briefcase, and because that's what we were trained to do. In fact, we weren't even called fighter pilots. We were called interceptor pilots because the mission of the Phantom was to launch from the aircraft carrier and go up to 70, 80,000 feet, shoot down the Russian bombers and make a 45-degree angle of bank and turn back and come back and land on the ship. So these guys were not trained to fight. They were trained to fight at arm's length. They were carrying Sparrow missiles. And in fact, at first, they didn't even have any sidewinders on those beauties. And so you were knocking down airplanes you couldn't even see with your missiles. So they were pretty easy prey, you know, these characters. Plus the fact that the F-9 was light and maneuverable, and the F-4, especially when it took off, was heavy and sluggish. And so we were pretty successful. Well, one bright day, after a particularly successful tour, Paul and I came back, and we're high-fiving and, you know, congratulating each other, and we walked into the ready room of this instrument training squadron with a big sign. It says, Plum and Kruke, report to the commanding officer of the F-4 squadron immediately. So here are these two characters, 22 or 23 at the time. Sweaty flight suits. I mean, we'd really been pulling G's with these Phantoms. And we're braced up in the doorway of this skipper of the F-4 squadron. He looked up, never forget this guy. He had a sweaty flight suit on, too, and he looked up at us. He said, "You the two guys out there in the F-9s?" We said, "Yes, sir, we were." Did you follow an F-4 through an entire loop? Yes, sir, we did. Did you have your guns trained on the F-4 the entire time? Yes, sir. Yeah, we did. He said, "You know who was in that F-4? "Well," he said, "you looked an awful lot like MiGs." He said, "I just came back from Vietnam. We're getting killed over there because we don't know how to fight these airplanes. How about doing it again tomorrow?" And so the next day and the next 6 months, Paul Kruke and I would man up our F-9 Cougar with our Snoopy goggles and our white scarves, and we'd go out and we would fight the Red Baron. And it was a wonderful piece of aviation just because we were just having so much fun. But that developed, we would come back and we would debrief these guys, and that developed into the Navy Fighter Weapons School, which later became Top Gun. So those were the initial training for Top Gun was almost accidental. I was in an F-4 Phantom Replacement Air Group, REG, and VF-121, and then joined my squadron, VF-114, the Aardvarks, on the Kitty Hawk that fall. Now we're in November of 1966, when I sit on the flight deck of the aircraft carrier Kitty Hawk and waved to my bride and promised her I'd be back in 8 months. Almost made it. Launched on the 5th of November, my wife's birthday. She wasn't happy about that, but remember, I promised her I'd be back in 8 months. And flew 74 combat missions in Vietnam. Was a pretty well-seasoned jet fighter pilot. 5 days before the end of my tour, feeling pretty bulletproof, I was on an alpha strike. This is the strikes sanctioned by the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They're this big-time stuff. 24 years old, I'm watching this armada of airplanes. This is as far as I could see. We had 3 aircraft carriers and 5 Air Force bases loaded with everything we had going towards all these targets in North Vietnam. Later found out it was Ho Chi Minh's birthday, and our psychological warfare guys, I guess, thought that that was going to demoralize them. So we dropped a lot of bombs that day, and I was fighter cover that day. Half the time my squadron dropped bombs, half the time we were in fighter cover missions. And so I was playing fighter that day, so I was just loaded with missiles. And I was on the edge of the flight, and my radar intercept officer, a guy in my back seat, picked up a bogey. It was about 20 miles out, and coming right at us, pretty high speed. And I slipped out. It was the only target in the sky. I'm thinking it's got to be a MiG. And so I'm out. You know, of course, the rules of engagement at the time was you had to visually ID the target before you shot him down. So I couldn't make a head-on shot. So the plan and the strategy was to make a high-speed pass and then pull up high, come back down on the guy. And I'd fought MiGs before, and so I was I'd never shot one down, but I knew pretty much what I was doing. But at about 4 miles away from that oncoming target, I recognized it's not a MiG at all. This is an A6 intruder. In fact, it was an EA-6, an electronic intruder that was jamming a lot of the radar sites of the SAMs, protecting this flight. Well, I may have been too far outside the formation at that time because his jammer wasn't working for me. And just after I passed this guy, I was hit by a SAM from behind. Now, interesting part of this was that we had no electronic, we had very little electronic countermeasures at the time. It was built as a high-altitude supersonic interceptor. We were supposed to fly higher than the SAMs could. That was the whole idea. So, in fact, the guys from the squadron would come back and talk to the new guys, you know, the newbies, and tell us what we're going to need for the war and all this stuff. And one of the guys said, yeah, the first thing you need to do is you go down to Radio Shack and buy yourself a Fuzzbuster. He said, the Russian SAM radar is same frequency as California Highway Patrol. So you get this radar, and because the Navy had not come up with this stuff yet, and sure enough, that's what I did. You know, a little suction cup and stick it on the canopy on the inside and run the little white wire down and under your G-suit and under your torso harness and up under your oxygen mask and into your ear, and you got a Fuzzbuster. Well, and it worked pretty well, actually. It had two frequencies of warble. One was when they sweep and one was when they lock on. And so you could tell when they were sweeping you. And then, you know, you got this the sphincter check when the thing actually locked on. What you didn't know was where they were coming from. There was no directional capability of this silly thing. It was just a receiver. So that particular day, with all these airplanes in the sky, these missiles were just zooming all over. And so the Fuzzbuster was just warbling like crazy. So, I'm jinking like crazy, and sure enough, I didn't even see this thing. I didn't even know what hit us. I didn't know if it was flak. We were probably 5,500 feet, 6,000 feet when it hit. So I was pretty sure it wasn't small arms fire, but it could have been a 57 millimeter flak. So, but it was a SAM. I later found out. It exploded some 12,000 pounds of jet fuel in that airplane, and my panel lit up like a Christmas tree. My stick was frozen. I had everything just failed at once. It was a complete catastrophic failure of that airplane, and the airplane started to come apart, and it started to tuck. It started to roll, and we were too close to the ground to eject inverted. The only manual control you have on an F-4 Phantom is a manually boosted rudder. The rudder is hydraulic, but if you hit the thing hard enough, you know, it took 40 pounds of pressure to move that rudder. And so that's what I did, and the airplane shuddered and rolled back upright where I ejected, my co-pilot ejected, our parachutes opened, and we came floating down over enemy territory. Just south of Hanoi, capital city. Pretty populated area. Well, first of all, I looked up at the panels and counted the panels in the parachute. And because that was the training. I later think about that and I think, well, that was just probably to try to calm yourself, you know, do something besides be afraid of what's about to happen to you. Looked down at the unknown. They're shooting at me. Small arms fire. I could hear this cracking small arms fire past. I'm thinking that's not fair. They just knocked down my multi-gazillion-dollar airplane. Now they're shooting at the pilot. I bowed my head and said a prayer, prayed for my wife, and prayed that I'd have the strength to endure whatever was going to happen to me on the ground. Pulled out my two-way radio, recognized that I was too far inland to be rescued, tore the antenna off the radio and threw it one way and the radio the other way. And I was over a rice paddy, so they landed in a rice paddy. I was the flight officer of the squadron, which meant I scheduled all the flying that all the guys in the squadron did, and I had my little book of schedules for all these guys. I had to carry it with me everywhere I went because everybody was asking me, hey, what hop am I on? Who am I flying with? What's the target? All this stuff. But I had their names in code just in case, you know, the thing would in any enemy hands, but I was really concerned that they would have more information than I wanted to give them. So I started ripping out these pages of this book and tearing them up and throwing them one way or the other. And about that time, I hit the ground. Let's talk about waist deep in a rice paddy. Descended upon by about a million of the North Vietnamese, mostly farmers at the beginning. just then militia, and then the regular army guys. They, of course, were pretty nasty. They, for some reason I still don't understand, they took all my clothes off, but they wouldn't use the zippers. You know, in these flight suits, you got 1,000 zippers. Everything zips on and off. G-suits and torso harness and survival gear, all this stuff zips. And they chose to cut this off with their machetes. And I don't know if they thought it was booby-trapped or what, but they cut all this stuff off and and dragged me around and, you know, just generally beat me up and showed me off to their people. Now, the air war is still going on. And so they finally decided to put me in a schoolhouse, and they tied me to a desk, tied and taped me to a desk where I couldn't move. And I sat there in that on the floor of the schoolhouse until all of the airplanes went away. And then they came back, and a couple of the soldiers. I was blindfolded and gagged also. A couple of soldiers came in and tossed me in the back of a pickup truck, and we started the ride towards Hanoi, which was pretty, you know, it was a pretty short ride. I don't know, it took us maybe a couple of hours to get there. Went to the Hanoi Hilton. They call it Wallo. Wallo means fiery forge in their language. It was a French prison, and built when the French occupied Vietnam back in the 1800s. And so they had the guillotine was there, you know, they had, the cells were 8 feet by 8 feet, and at the, with different configurations, but usually 4 beds in an 8 foot by 8 foot cell, bunk beds. Your legs were at the end of the bed, your legs were actually clamped down by metal clamps that could be locked from outside the cell. There was kind of a little mechanism there with a little hinge on the clamp, and it went outside the cell block and then clamped, and they actually locked you in with these leg shackles. And so I was alone. I was in solitary confinement there at first. I had some burns, and I'd hurt my back in the ejection, but no serious injuries. I was tortured for 2 days for primarily propaganda. They didn't really know enough serious questions to ask me. I was surprised at that. Now, I didn't know a whole lot, and I'm a pretty nugget aviator anyway, and we didn't have a PSYOP, a nuclear weapons function as fighter pilots. And so I didn't have any, I mean, I had a top secret clearance, but I didn't know a whole lot of top secret stuff. And so they asked me, you know, about future targets and stuff like that. And of course, I tried my best to stick with the code of conduct, name, rank, serial number, date of birth. And about the third time they wrapped me up and took their goon squad to me, I decided this is not going to work. I'm gonna die doing this. And so I started lying to them. And now, I'd always been cautioned in survival school, you're cautioned not to lie to the enemy. And they say it makes it worse. But we found out, and I'm not the only one. In fact, I think nearly every prisoner over there found out that you could lie. And they would accept the lie. And then they were embarrassed to come back and admit that you'd pull the wool over their eyes. It was a face-saving thing. And it was crazy. But in any case, I started to lie to them. So I didn't, you know, I never gave them anything that they could ever use. But I also didn't stick to name, rank, serial number, date of birth, which nobody did. But I didn't know that. And I felt very embarrassed and guilty, you know, those first several months in that prison camp, because I kind of felt like I was the only one to give in to the enemy. And it was that this was pretty standard. Most of us, you know, and felt that way and were really reluctant to communicate with other Americans because of this pride thing, you know. We just didn't want to compare ourselves to these other guys who had been stronger than we were. I was there 2 or 3 weeks, I guess, and I'd found a rag that I was just wearing around my waist, and they gave me some pajamas and a drawstring and a shirt and black pajamas. I never had a belt or a button or a zipper in the entire 6 years. And so I did have some clothes. They provided a mat and a mosquito net. I don't think we'd be alive today. The prisoners probably would not have survived had they not given us a mosquito net. And the second thing is they boiled all of our water. They boiled all of their own water. So they knew that, and of course, you know, all of the Red River Delta is kind of a swamp. So, and they have no sewer system to speak of. At least they didn't back then. So it's pretty wretched water. So they had to boil all their water. So they gave us water. It wasn't enough, especially for the big guys, but we'd get a couple of liters of water a day. So we'd get a bowl of rice in the morning, bowl of rice at night, and this rice was about, it was maybe a big coffee cup full of rice. That was the mainstay, and that's what kept me alive. They would sometimes give you a side bowl of a broth that was made from turnips or cabbage or kohlrabi is another tuberous plant they've got over there. Sometimes we couldn't really identify what was in it. And there was no meat at all. I didn't have enough meat to fill a cereal bowl for a year. And I was kind of concerned about that, you know, but I found that you can live a long time on rice. It's a pretty good food. It was palatable. It was. Lots of times you had bugs in it, you know, weevils or worms of some kind, protein. And so you'd crunch down. In fact, my buddy Jerry Coffey wrote a poem. It's called Ode to a Weevil. And it's a very short poem. It says, little weevil in my bread, I think I just bit off your head. And that was it.
You have been listening to EAA's Timeless Voices of Aviation on Warbird Radio. Please stay tuned as we pause for this commercial break.
This is Warbird Radio.
Log on now to FightingColors.com. That's FightingColors.com for more on Gary Velasco and his amazing nose art. That's FightingColors.com.
Hi, I'm Chris.
And I'm Rob.
And we're two of the crew members from Warbird Rescue. Call in Thursday nights at 8 Eastern to join the lively discussion of Warbird restoration. Find out how we can put you in touch with a Warbird project in your area. And be sure to visit us online at warbirdrescue.com.
That's warbirdrescue.com.
And we'll talk to you Thursdays at 8 right here on Warbird Radio.
Now showing on aerocinema.com.
1944. The English Channel is all that stands between a massive land invasion into Hitler's Europe. The Allies are poised and ready to make the crossing, and the Nazis are desperate to repel them. Using new technology and innovative concepts, the Luftwaffe will summon forth a dive bomber unique in looks and abilities. This will be their shield to defend against the flood of ships bound for German territory. A Pair of Hunchbacks, Part 1.
What a kick to be part of Warbird Radio with Big Band Jump, heard several times each week. I'm Don Kennedy, host of BBJ, inviting you to tune in, take off with Warbird Radio.
Live from the land of the free, because of the brave, this is Warbird Radio.
On this episode of Warbird Radio Presents, we explore the archives of the EAA. Here now is the coordinator of the Timeless Voices Oral History Program, Zach Boffman.
Mm-hmm.
now return to EAA's Timeless Voices of Aviation on Warbird Radio.
Eventually, a guy was passed a wire through a hole in the wall and got it into my prison cell. And he passed me a code on a piece of toilet paper written in ink made from ashes and brick dust. And I started to communicate with this man with this code. The code was a series of numbers to represent various letters of the alphabet or abbreviations. And so he would tug on this wire and I would get the number of tugs on the other end, and very cumbersome code, but it worked. Turns out this guy, Bob Shoemaker, EAA member for a long time, flies a glass air. His son is an EAA member, flies a RV, I think. And so, of course, we knew nothing of that stuff, but he was a Navy pilot and had been there for 2 years when I showed up. I knew that they had long-term prisoners. Ev Alvarez had been shot down while I was still in flight training, and that was the first Navy guy, well, the first guy to be shot down in August of 1965. 19th of May of 1967, I was shot down. So I started communicating with this guy, Shoemaker, and that was very comforting to know that there was somebody else who'd been there for 2 years and had still survived. And so I felt like that was going to be a I was going to be able to make it. You know, he really pretty much explained to me that this was a mental game. You know, that I was going to have to have a strong faith. I was going to have to really a faith in God and a faith in the country and a faith in the flag and a faith in each other and a faith in myself. Just be a believer that this whole thing is going to come out and successfully. He said, you still have control of the decisions you make. So you can decide to be a victim and cower away in the corner of this prison cell and atrophy and die. And about a fourth of the prisoners of war in Korea did that. He said, they just decided that that was the end of their life. And it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. He said, it takes a lot of courage, you know, to get back up after you've been knocked down. And he said, believe me, you're going to get down, knocked down a lot. And you're going to get tired of standing back up just so you can be knocked down again. He said, but every time you get back up, you feel a little bit stronger that you can make this. And it was true. Even in the torture, you know, I found that you could establish certain plateaus of pain. And you know, they would stretch my arms and legs and bend me up like a human pretzel, and I would think to myself, man, this really hurts. But I'd think, if it doesn't get any worse than this, I can take it. I can survive this. And then it got worse. And then I'd say, okay, I'm still here. I'm still breathing, and it hurts. But if it doesn't get any worse than this, I'll survive. And then it got worse. And so you get these plateaus of pain going on, and It's like Shoemaker said, it was all a mental game. To begin with, everyone recognized from the very beginning how vital it was to communicate. It was a surprising, life-saving function. To the point that if a guy was put in a prison cell in the far corner of the camp and couldn't or wouldn't communicate with the rest of us, he probably wasn't going to make it. It was just that serious. And the irony of it was, it wasn't the information we were passing around. It wasn't, you know, escape plans or military secrets or any of that stuff. It wasn't even the words. It was the simple validation of another human being. Because in those prison cells, especially if it was dark and you were in solitary confinement, your mind would just start to play tricks on you, and you wouldn't know if you were even alive. You had no sounding board. There was no feedback. There was nothing to tell me that I really exist. So the simple tugging on a wire and to have that wire tugged back meant two things. Number one, somebody's responding to something I am doing physically. Thus, I exist. And number two, somebody cares. So it started for me with this code. We call it the TAP code. It's a 5x5 matrix of the alphabet. 5 lines, 5 rows. Numbers across the top, down the side, so that each letter would be represented by 2 numbers. Number of the line, then the number of the row. A, 1, 1, first line, first row. Z, fifth line, fifth row. Substituted a K for a C, or C for a K, and so that it came out 5x5. And then we use that TAP code in a lot of different ways. Any time that we found that we could hear another prisoner make any kind of a sound, we would make a code, a communication technique from that sound. So, if a guy got outside to chop wood for the fire, for instance, he would chop in this code. Chop, 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 chop. Chop, 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 chop. Chop, 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 chop. And so it became a radio station because everybody could hear this guy chopping. And he's actually, you know, telling the, maybe a new prisoner came in and said who won the World Series. And so as one of them I remember that the guy actually chopped out, you know, the teams of the World Series and everybody in the camp could pick it up. We found out that they didn't pay much attention when we made guttural noises. I mean, they wouldn't let us speak at all. In fact, even when you got a roommate, you had to whisper to your roommate. But you could go around coughing and spitting all day. So we designated various letters of the alphabet or abbreviations to be represented by combinations of coughs, sneezes, spits, or wheezes. So you'd wake up in the morning, hear the guys in the cell next door go, that means good morning, how are you? In the friendliest way. So we had all varieties. We would write notes on pieces of toilet paper in ink made from ashes or brick dust, fold that note up around, tie it around a rock, heave the rock from one cell to another. We call that airmail. We would leave notes various places. We had one little mailbox in one of the camps I was in called the Plantation. In fact, that's the first time I ran into John McCain again. I was shot down in May. He was shot down that same August. I believe it was August, May, June, July. Yeah. Of 67. So he came into the camp. And his cell was right across the path from the sewer house. We had, it was a little brick building over the top of a sewer. I mean, it was a hole in the ground. It wasn't really a sewer. But this is where we took our 2-gallon bucket every 3 or 4 days and marched down there and poured out our bucket in the sewer. Well, the bad news was this sewer was just putrid. I mean, even when we were used to the POW-type smells, this was absolutely the worst of the worst. The good news is, the guards would not follow us into this little brick house. And so it was the only time that we would be alone in this little house. So we would carry our little notes, you know, in our little drawstring belt in our bucket. And while we were in the little sewer house, we would put our notes in between various bricks. And everybody had a mailbox, and so a P.O. box, if you will. So we would stick our note in between bricks for our different buddies, and we would communicate that way. So all varieties of communication, all very vital. And again, wasn't the data we were passing around. It was just the validation of other people. And that was always priority one, is to find out who's coming in and out of the camp. When we'd get switched to a new camp, that was an immediate thing. And everybody knew it, that the first thing we would do was try to figure out who was in there. And one reason, of course, was to find out who was in charge. Because in the military, you have a various hierarchy, obviously. And so by rank and by lineal number, you could tell who was calling the shots. And so that was one of the first things you did, was to pass around your name and your rank and your lineal number to find out, hey, who's the SRO, the senior residing officer of this camp. And so we maintain our military discipline just by communicating and figuring out who's in there. The other really important reason why we had to keep track of who the POWs were is that we were so afraid that the enemy would not let us all go home at the end of the war. And for whatever reason, you know, they would keep some guys behind. And so it was just vital that we know and memorize the names of everybody we had seen alive there so that in the final tally we could figure out if they were keeping anybody behind. These prison cells were, for the most part, storehouses, warehouses. And some of them were chicken coops, and they were all just kind of plugged together. Only the Hanoi Hilton was a formalized jail. And so we were in these makeshift rooms. And so a lot of them had vent holes at the top or windows. And so the Vietnamese would cover up these windows because they didn't want us to see out. And they do this with bamboo mats. They held the mats onto both sides of the wall with wire. So they would run the wire through and draw it back, and they would twist the wire and hold these mats on. So we saw this happening, and so about every day you'd go up and you'd untwist about a half a twist from this wire. And after about a month, you know, the thing was dilapidated, and it would, and the screen would fall down. Which did two things for you. One of them, you've finally got some light and some air in that cell, and the other thing is you had a supply of wire. Now, you had to hide it, which was not easy. But the interesting thing that we found was that the guards looked at your cell from eye level down and rarely ever looked up in your prison cell. And so if you could find a way to put it up to a thatched roof or in the corrugated tin of a roof or in the rafters or that kind of thing, you could hide this wire. And so that's where he got it. He got this wire from untwisting the panels of this bamboo matting and then piecing them together and stuffed them out of a hole in his cell wall. It was actually 14 feet, as I recall, that he fished this wire over the boxes and around the shovels and through the ropes and into the little hole in my cell wall. So it was pretty phenomenal. And he told me many years later that he had a little diagram on his floor where he'd shove it out a certain amount and then he'd bend it a little bit and then he'd move it over this way and shove it a little more. And so it was quite a task just to communicate with me. We loved to get outside, and they didn't let us out very much at all. You were lucky if you got out once every couple of months to get some fresh air. But if they had a load of rice they wanted unloaded from a truck, they had quite a surplus of coal dust. For whatever reason, they would have this coal, and it was just stacked up in piles. These trucks would bring in this coal dust, and they would dump it out. Well, to use this coal in their furnaces and in their and their stoves, it had to be balled up. And so they'd send you outside, if you're lucky enough, and give you a tub of water and a pile of coal dust. And so you'd make, like, snowballs. Well, one of our heroes there, who was a Navy sailor by the name of Douglas Hegdal from Clark, South Dakota, he was 19 years old on the fantail of the cruiser Canberra. In the middle of the night, and the ship burped, and he fell off. And so, he was the only enlisted guy in that prison camp for a long time, because we were all fighter pilots, and it was an air war. We were being shot down, and so we had 200 top guns, and here comes this Navy sailor. His great line was, "I wasn't captured like you guys. I was rescued." Well, he... But I mean, what a guy. This guy is our hero. One of the many things he did was he got his little pile of coal dust out there and his bucket of water, and it was in a garage with two or three trucks, you know, army trucks. And so while the guards weren't watching, he undid the fuel cover in one of these trucks, and about every third coal ball, he would dump in the fuel of his truck. And all three of those trucks were towed away from that garage. None of them ever worked after that. So that was Hegdal. Things got better about 1970 or 71 when the Paris peace talks started, and there was a lot more anguish. A lot of the wives of the POWs got together and started to make a lot of noise. The military didn't like that at all, but these gals weren't gonna shut up. And these were gals like Sybil Stockdale, Jim Stockdale's wife. Some of the others. But they, you know, the wives got together, and some of them went to Paris for the peace talks, and were pretty effective, I think, in getting the word out. The bracelets came out. The silver bracelets were all of our names on them, just to remind people that there were still prisoners over there. Phyllis Galante, that's the other gal who was really instrumental in that. Paul Galante, he was a flight instructor of mine. In fact, he tells this story. I don't really remember it happening quite this way, but one of the first days I was in the camp, I was going to an interrogation, and I passed by his cell, and I hear this guy in there, "What's your name?" I said, "Plum. What's your name?" He said, "Galante, I'm your old flight instructor." He says, I said, "Well, why didn't you wash me out?" But Paul's a good guy, and his wife Phyllis was very active with Mrs. Stockdale to just bring a worldwide awareness of our plight and how long we'd been there and what the problems were. And so, anyway, the treatment improved. The other part of that was Ho Chi Minh died in 1969, I think, summer of 69. And so they didn't have his influence there, and somebody else decided, hey, one of these days we're going to have to let these guys go, and we're going to use them as trading chips, which of course they did, and we better treat them a little better. So the torture stopped basically after, I think, 71 or so, and we got a little better food, and so, you know, things started to work. After about 3 or 4 years there, again, when the treatment started to improve, they allowed us to write a six-line letter, and then they would censor this letter, and they didn't just block out your words; they actually cut them out. And so my wife would get these, I don't know, maybe half a dozen letters on actually postcard kind of a thing, that were all cut out with, you know, six or eight letters, or I mean words from the letter was absolutely cut out. And I received a letter too from her after I was there for 4 years. So she knew I was alive. She didn't know I was sane, and she didn't know if I'd ever come home, but she did know that I was alive. It was never a Hogan's Hero kind of a prison camp. And so it was only in the very final days when they were trying to fatten us up. When they knew we were going home, a peace treaty apparently had been signed. We didn't know it. But things got a whole lot better. And they let us outside. They gave us a basketball. We had concerts and all this stuff. And that. Oh, yeah. But, see, they had tried to trick us before. And they would tell us we were going home, and all you have to do is sign this confession, and you're out of here. And of course, it was a trick. But yeah, we knew something was up, and we were pretty excited about it. But we'd been tricked so many times, I think we were kind of reluctant to believe it. And so we, even when they got better food, allowed us to get out in the sunshine a little bit, even after all of that, we were sure still skeptical. It wasn't really until they came in with a piece of toilet paper, and this is the big wrapping paper, European kind of toilet paper, and traced our feet on the toilet paper. did we really figure it out? Because, of course, we hadn't had shoes for 6 years, and we figured that, sure enough, that they were fitting us for some real shoes. And so that was the first real indication. Then of course the bombing stopped. I mean, that was pretty good news, but that had happened before. And the last bombing was the B-52s, Operation Arc Light, and this was in late 1972, November, December 72, and the B-52s just filled the skies. And it was pretty amazing. And they were dropping a lot of bombs. And we had seen the guards react or not react to various bombing raids. And, you know, a little A-4 or F-4 or A-6 would... You know, it got to the point where they didn't even take cover for the little guys. But the B-52s really got their attention. Just scared the bejesus out of these guys. Because, I mean, you know, got, 104,000 pounds of bombs that are just dropping. And it made quite an impression. And we feel like it helped end the war, those B-52 guys. And a lot of them were shot down. And so we have a lot of affection for the B-52 drivers that came down there and dropped those bombs. Well, so bombing ended. We got our feet measured. The camp commander came into our cell and said, "Hey, today's the day. You guys are going home. You know, you got shoes, you got pants, you got shirts. Get out of here." Our senior man said, "No, sir, we're not going home until all the sick, injured and enlisted men have left this camp." And that was another part of our communication and discipline in that camp, was we weren't going to go home until we knew all the guys who were hurt had gone. Well, this started an international incident, because Kissinger was out there and he was saying, you know, "You guys come on home." And we said, "No, we're not going to do that. And we want to make sure that our buddies are there." Oh, not only that, but we had to be released by shoot down order, so that the guys who were there the longest came back the first. And so this camp commander disappeared. About 2 hours later, he came back with a computerized readout. This is 1973, pretty rare, especially in an Asian country. And sure enough, it was the manifest of the first plane load of guys. And it was also our prayer list, the sick, injured, and enlisted men among us. So they'd gone, and now it was our turn. And so we formed a platoon outside that cell in military fashion. It's a bunch of scruffy old guys, you know, calling cadence, marching out the gate and onto the bus and over the bus. And there's a beautiful C-141 sitting there, an Air Guard airplane. And it was quite emotional, but still the real emotion wasn't until we got aboard the airplane and rolling down the runway and lifting off enemy soil. That's when we all broke loose and started hugging and kissing the Air Force nurses. 90 minutes later, Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines. Ran to the first phone I could find, called my wife, told her the good news, and she was gone. And I called my parents back in Kansas, and they said she hung on for 5 years, then 3 months ago she filed for divorce. She finally gave up, and she's engaged to another guy. So I came back to Great Lakes Naval Hospital down here in Chicago, and was in rehabilitation for 2 weeks. I felt at first like I was probably going to just move on with my life and trying to forget this 6 years of prison and the pain that it caused, and move to some little town in the middle of nowhere and where they've never heard of Charlie Plum. If they have, I'll change my name, just because I thought that was what I would do. And then I ran into a reporter that I was at a little press conference in the basement of that hospital, and this reporter, after he had interviewed me, he chased me down and sneaked into this elevator just as the doors were closing. And he said, he had tears and he had anguish and, you know, just really a mess. He said, "Mr. Plum, you really got to me in here." I said, I've had a miserable year. My family has fallen apart and my job is terrible. He said, "I even wondered if I wanted to go on living." He said, "You've given me hope." So it suddenly occurred to me that this story, this experience, and the telling of it could give people hope. And so I thought, well, you know, if there's a benefit to this, then it's worth telling. So I appreciate you guys here helping me tell the story.
Thank you for listening to EAA's Timeless Voices of Aviation Oral History Program on Warbird Radio. Please visit www.timelessvoices.org to learn more about the program or watch video versions of this and hundreds of other interviews that tell the story of human flight. Tune in again for more Timeless Voices of Aviation on Warbird Radio.